Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, March 13th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio, Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
Joining us later will be Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle, Alex Darris at the Provincetown Banner, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times. We'll talk with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, hear from Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and speak with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Ethan, as of this morning, the Cape and the South Coast and the islands do not have a reported case of someone with the new coronavirus. But it seems to be all that people are talking about. And looking over the news stories this week, there's a sense from local health officials that there are questions and issues around testing for this, which means that the information that they're working with may not be complete.
Yeah, so there's no confirmed cases, like you said, on the Cape or on the islands, but we don't know how many people have actually been tested. So that's kind of just because we don't know. Doesn't mean that no one has it. And health officials have basically said it's not if, it's a when is it going to happen. We're not immune out here. So, yeah, it's a question. And there have been people wondering kind of how much testing is going on down here. We still don't know how many people around the Cape and Islands have been actually tested. And they're still not readily available test kits.
So folks who feel like they may have the coronavirus, they can't just go and ask for a test because the tests even have to be okayed from the state level.
Yeah, the state health department has to give, they kind of run you through the symptoms and kind of they go through a background. Have you been to certain places around the world? And you basically have to check off all these boxes before you even kind of qualify for a test.
Your reporter, Cindy McCormick, this week spoke with one doctor, Dr. Timothy Bilouris. I'm not sure if I got the name right pronouncing, but Timothy Bilouris, who says that he believes that it could be here very easily already and that we just haven't really tested for it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. That person either just hasn't checked all those boxes or they haven't met all the criteria. But yeah, I think, I mean, it's most people aren't saying we don't think it's here. It's kind of we just haven't found it yet. There have been some. There was at least one test that came back negative. We believe the person was diagnosed with bronchitis. That was according to the doctor you just mentioned. But yeah, I mean, it is kind of such a fluid situation right now. Everyone's kind of trying to grapple with what's going on as things like the NBA get canceled. I mean, I think it's starting to hit for people this week. It kind of really started to hit for everybody.
This did seem to be the turning point week as the governor came out with this state of emergency and things are really ramping up. The response, it seems like, is really ramping up. Meanwhile, hospitals and nursing homes have been taking precautions by placing restrictions on visiting patients as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, the elderly and people who already have some health issues are the most at risk for this, for COVID-19. So you can imagine that kind of placing some tighter restrictions on visiting those folks had to be put in place. So right now, only one designated caregiver, parents, spouse, legal guardian, can visit patients at Falmouth or Cape Cod Hospital. Other ones are kind of they're screening visitors to make sure you don't have any symptoms or have you traveled through areas where COVID-19 has been pretty widespread. So everyone's kind of taking some extra precautions here. Obviously, with our elderly population here in Cape Cod, this could be a huge deal.
And in the end, they're looking for, again, the symptomology that they're looking for in people has to do with fevers and coughing and even dizziness is one of the symptoms that they're saying that they're on the lookout for from people who may present with this.
Yeah, and they're also discouraging people, not just those symptoms, but if you've traveled in places like China, Iran, Italy, South Korea in the past 2 weeks, that's basically a no-go for a lot of nursing homes, just because there's a chance, if you, even if you're not showing any symptoms, there could still be an issue.
And they're looking to protect not only, I thought this was interesting, not only the patients at the nursing homes or hospitals, but staff need to be protected because if they get infected, then you can understand the system starts to break down at a certain point. It would be the concern.
Yeah, absolutely. You want the people caring for the unhealthy to be healthy. I think that kind of goes without saying. And, I mean, this is kind of enacted things. The thing that this virus has really done, I think, is make people look at kind of possible procedures that have been placed and not really questioned before. So, I mean, a lot of places are totally new cleaning procedures, especially high-use places like doorknobs or handrails are kind of being cleaned around the clock.
It's happening at nursing homes and hospitals. It's also happening in places of business now. And even going to the supermarket, we had a reporter out yesterday standing in a supermarket where there was no cleaning products left in the aisles. And people are very conscious right now of trying to keep all the surfaces clean around them. You took a look at the possible impacts some of this might have for the Cape's tourism industry. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, a lot of businesses on the Cape rely on kind of this 90-day, 12-week period of summer to make it through the whole year. So if pistons aren't firing on fully, that can be a real issue. And especially when a lot of this involves travel. So we talked to a bunch of businesses, some Chamber of Commerce folks, and people aren't super worried that the summer season, the tourism season, is going to be kind of canceled, but they're definitely keeping their eye on this.
What kinds of concerns? Like, there must be concerns around the visa workers who have to come in and work.
I mean,
summer season here.
Yeah, so I mean, we have a huge J-1 visa foreign workers. We don't get a huge amount usually from the areas that are kind of being locked down. There's not a huge Italian contingent or South Korean contingent. But even still, there's with the new European travel ban, there could be all kinds of issues, and things are changing so rapidly right now. So you can imagine places that rely on foreign workers are kind of wondering, are we going to get everybody? And it's not just workers. I mean, it's tourists as well. People are going to be traveling this summer? I mean, it's only a few months away, and this is kind of the preparatory period for all of this.
Was there anyone, a business owner that you spoke to specifically that had a story about how they were trying to grapple with this?
Businesses, a lot of them have enacted new cleaning policies, done extra steps like that. Some businesses, like coffee shops, have stopped doing the bring your own thermos situation to kind of stop that. One pizza place in Hyannis started offering curbside pickup and is encouraging card-only transactions to kind of stop hand-to-hand contact as much. A lot of people are kind of taking a look at everything that they've been doing. There could be some pluses as if international travel gets kind of shut down. The Cape is a big domestic travel destination. Usually people driving within 5 to 8 hours is kind of our wheelhouse. So it could push more people here. One group at Chatham Bars Inn was supposed to go to San Francisco, a business group, and they actually canceled those plans and moved their business group to Chatham Bars Inn. So, I mean, we'll see if that holds. But people are trying to be optimistic about the summer season as it comes on.
We had a reporter out yesterday who spoke with a business owner who was considering whether the cashiers at this establishment should now be wearing gloves when handling the money, and feeling like unsure whether that sends a message to the customers that things, you know, a scarier message, or whether that sends a reassuring message that we're taking care of people and we're, taking care of the situation. I think it really points to the question that people are trying to unpack here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, I think, kind of, you want to show people that you're thinking about it and caring about it, but you also don't want to be alarmist. And I think, especially in the business community, you don't want people to think that they shouldn't be going out to your business. But yeah, I mean, a lot of other businesses have said, if you have symptoms, please don't come in, too. So it's for us, it should be interesting because we rely so much on that 3 month period of summer.
Yeah. Let's look at a couple other stories in the paper this week that aren't related to the virus. The Cape Cod Commission has released a report on the first phase of the Herring River Restoration Project. This is an immense project with a number of moving parts. The commission has come out largely favorable to it.
Yeah, so this project, it intends to restore, I mean, this is one of the largest estuaries in New England back to its original state. Back in the 1900s, the Chequesset Neck Road Dike was built, and that basically kind of really choked off that area. I think it's like 1,000 acres of salt marsh upstream from there. And that led to degradation of water quality, loss of the tidal habitat, shellfish areas were closed. So they're trying to kind of get that back to where it once was, and that it's going to involve some kind of flooding of it, but it has to happen kind of incrementally. Otherwise, you could have just this massive sea change of what's going on.
This is going to happen in phases, and right now they're really looking at phase one. And again, as you say, the incremental aspect of this is so important because they want to be able to control what's happening. But even right now, they don't have all the details worked out. This is still like a draft form of how this plan is going forward. It sounded like it was met with a lot of positive commentary as well from folks as the commission presented this report.
Yeah, and so this meeting on this plan happened this week, and there was, I think, more than 100 people there. So even amid coronavirus issues, people are really passionate
about
it.
Although it was on Monday, and things have been changing so rapidly, you might not be able to get 100 people out to a meeting by the end of the week.
No, yes. Absolutely. I mean, there are some things that people are looking to pay a little more attention to, like funding sources for implementing this and adaptive management plans. And they want to kind of, the subcommittee for this project really kind of wants to keep discussions about this going. There are a couple concerns, but mostly people were in favor of this.
A couple concerns from some property owners and folks running the project are saying that they're going to be on top of that these properties won't be impacted, and kind of offering some reassurances around that.
Yeah, I mean, people worried about their properties being flooded. The project would pay for that, according to the town administrator up in Wellfleet.
You wrote a story this week about a big transportation bond bill coming out of the Massachusetts House. It has money in it for a number of Cape projects. The big one here is improving the roads connecting to the Cape bridges.
Yeah, so this was in Governor Baker's $18 billion transportation bond bill. And it's important to know that bond bills are basically authorizing you to borrow money. So it's kind of like these bills end up being like a priority list of things you want. So this doesn't mean the money's actually there. I think that's important to get out. But in that bill, there was $350 million to improve the roadways around the two bridges, our automobile bridges. That got cut out. That was originally in the governor's version of the bill. It got cut out sometime during the committee process. Sarah Peake up in Provincetown, our state rep, filed an amendment to get that back in there, and that made it through the House and is on its way to the Senate.
The bridges themselves, as we've said before, they're not state-owned. The state only connects the roads to them. So
yeah,
that's kind of a secondary. The road work is almost secondary to the bridges themselves, but Sarah Peake makes a point here saying that it's sending a message that the state is ready to go through with this.
Yeah, the state has basically said, getting new bridges and still having that same infrastructure we have there now is just going to create a choke point. So you need to kind of fix it all at once.
And since the Army Corps of Engineers controls the bridges, so having the state say, we've got money ready to go, and sending the message that they're ready for this project and try to put some momentum behind it on a federal level. What else was in that bond bill that had some some Cape ties?
One of the biggest, the other big ones in here was Rep. Fernandez here in Woods Hole got in $10 million to upgrade the rail infrastructure between North Falmouth and Buzzards Bay so it could accommodate commuter rail service. And the MassDOT is in the process of creating a study to look at commuter rail service to tie into the long-awaited South Coast Rail project. Buzzards Bay has been trying to tie into commuter rail for a long time. So this could maybe push that even a little more.
But as you say, as you caution, this is a bond bill. It's a little bit of a priority wish list also.
Yeah, and this still has to go through the Senate. So all of these could be theoretically scrapped at the end of the day and never see into the actual bill.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Emergency planners on Martha's Vineyard have been taking steps to prepare for the new coronavirus. Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette joins us now with an update. Hiya, Bill.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. Thanks for being with us.
That is good.
Your reporter, Louisa Hufstadter, sat down with the CEO of Martha's Vineyard Hospital. What did she hear?
Well, first off, it's just, I don't know if you've seen this too, but a story that really traveled through the entire paper. I've never seen that before, from the front page with the hospital CEO down to the calendar page with all the events being canceled. It really was just a monumental time. But for the front page story, Louisa Hufstadter did get to sit down with CEO Denise Cipici and her team, which was really great and informative. First off, this, at least as of yesterday afternoon, Ms. Cipici said that there are no confirmed cases on the island as of yet, but she did say it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. It will come here. There's no way around that, she said. So that is what they are preparing for.
And what are some of the ways that they're preparing?
Well, what was interesting, one of the main thrusts of the conversations was we need healthy doctors. You know, we're all sort of worried about ourselves and our families, of course, but if and when we do get sick, we need healthy doctors. So a lot of it, what they're preparing is really trying to help screen patients before they get there so that they come wandering in and infect everybody, because if the doctors go down and the hospital staff, which is already overworked with the phone calls and everybody coming in and, you know, everybody being worried. So they are really restricting access. They're asking people who feel they have symptoms to call their primary care physician. Don't just come on in. If, of course, it feels like an emergency situation, go to the emergency room, but wear a mask. They have stopped, you know, people going to the cafeteria, screening people before they go to the nursing home Windermere. So a lot of it is really restricting access to the hospital until they know, you know, what's going on, which was sort of a good way of remembering it.
Now, in this story here, they also speak a little bit about people from the island sort of making off with some of the hospital supplies as they come in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's life in an emergency. So, you know, the stores at the store shelves are depleted. But then that was sort of, you know, a shock to find out that you go to the hospital and grab the sanitizers and masks and things like that. So, I mean, it's one of those situations, and we all do need to take a step back and, you know, not fall into the hysteria. You know, it's better for all of us if we do that.
You also, in the story, cover a little bit of the community efforts, including how the bank is promoting social distancing.
Yeah, so the bank, you know, trying to say, you know, do your online banking. Thought it was interesting, you know, the jail, you know, even visitations to the jail, no physical contact. It's just everywhere, as it is all over the world. And, you know, it's a day-by-day thing. We talked to the superintendent of the schools, who met with all the principals yesterday. They haven't canceled the schools yet, but that could change at any moment, so we're following that closely, too.
I feel like the schools really is maybe the next big home-hitting impact here, as we've seen schools up in Boston being closed for a period of time now. And that's the thing lots of folks are watching.
Yeah, I have two kids in the school system, in grammar school and high school here. So, you know, they went off to school today, and I urged them, you know, to wash their hands a lot and no touching and stuff like that. But the school superintendent did say, you know, start thinking about childcare, because this could happen at any time. There's, you know, they could maybe say it later today. We don't know. But parents should be thinking about how they're going to deal with, you know, kids out of school and what that means. So there's so many pieces to the puzzle, not just, you know, making sure that you wash your hands and social distancing, but also starting to plan for, you know, what comes next.
Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve. Take care.
Voters at a special town meeting in Chatham this weekend chose to ignore the recommendation of selectmen by approving a study to look at an alternative site for a new senior center. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us for an update. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, we've been talking about this for weeks. Was it a surprise that this passed and by such a comfortable margin?
I think it was a little surprising that it passed by such a margin. The vote Saturday was 297 to 143. And as you said, that was despite the fact that both the selectmen had opposed this and the school committee had voted that they weren't going to give up this property, which is part of the middle school, the Monomoy Middle School land, and it's leased to the school department, even though it's owned by the town. But voters decided that they were going to override that and add this as a second possible senior site to be studied by a consultant that is already working on studying the land at 1610 Main Street, which voters had targeted back in January as a potential senior center site. And this Monday, selectmen decided that even though they did not support this, they would sanction going ahead with that study, even though they made it clear that they weren't really happy about that. Another development in this story, Steve, is that Saturday there was a planned public meeting to update the public on the status of that 1610 Main Street land study, but that has been canceled, along with, as you know, most other public meetings that were happening around the Cape. But the selectmen are still planning to meet here in Chatham Monday evening at 6 p.m., and that presentation will be given to them by owner's project manager Rick Pomeroy at the board's meeting. Now, the selectmen and town officials are urging residents not to attend that meeting in person. It's going to be broadcast on Channel 18 and on the town's website. It'll be streamed live, and residents can email questions to ask the consultants during that presentation. So we'll have an update on that on Monday. And again, selectmen are urging people to watch that meeting instead of attend the meeting.
Hey, Tim, briefly, I want to ask you about another story you've got in the paper, a very Cape Cod story. It has to do with some fishing equipment that's been stored on a Chatham beach each winter, going back maybe generations?
Yeah, as far as we know, it's at least since the early 60s, if not earlier, that weir fishermen that have fish traps out in Nantucket Sound, they store the poles during the winter on Harding's Beach, the end of Harding's Beach right on Stage Harbor. Now, that beach is owned by the town, and recently the state attorney general's office received a complaint alleging that the town was allowing private businesses to use public property. Town manager Jill Goldsmith said she was contacted about that last month, and after some research, they determined that there was never any formal authorization by the town for use of that property. So the selectmen this past week, or last week actually, decided that they would set up a permit system to allow the two remaining trap fishing companies to continue to store their poles now. There's about 500 poles that are stored there. There was some concern about possible contamination because of paint that used to be used on the poles, but they don't use that paint anymore, we're told. But representatives of both the weir companies said that they could probably absorb a nominal fee for a permit, but if they had to find a new location for the poles, they weren't sure if they'd be able to do that at this point. So selectmen decided to allow that with an annual permit fee of $100 a year.
That is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
Sid Wehner and Son, the iconic food distributor based in New Bedford, is being sold, but the family business will continue to have family members helping lead the company. Jack Spillane joins us from the Standard Times with the story. Good morning, Jack.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Jack. We talked about this briefly on the program when this deal was first announced. Now we have some more details about what role the family will play in the newly organized business, and it sounds like it's a lot about continuity.
Yes, there was some concern in New Bedford after the sale as to who would control the company. And so we have learned that Henry Wehner, who is the grandson of the founder, will continue in his role as the CEO, and his daughter Allie, who's very involved, will continue as the head of sales. So people in Greater New Bedford were encouraged to hear that. You know, they run a popular store there with some of the gourmet food produce items, especially, and people were encouraged to hear that.
And it's a great story because it really unpacks some of the history behind this business and why it's so meaningful to the region. And it even touches on Martha's Vineyard, that the way the whole business evolved.
Yes, it was just a regular food produce stand when his grandfather founded it. And Sid, early in his career, spent some time working with the restaurants over in the vineyard, and they were looking for some exotic, unusual ingredients, and he had to find a way to find them, and he went to California to do that. So the vineyard played a big role in the growth of this business.
Hey, I want to ask you about another story you've got in the paper this week, which is about a big cancellation that we should talk about on the South Coast. The New Bedford Half Marathon will not be happening.
Yes, so the half marathon occurs about a month before the marathon in Boston, and it's a preparatory run for a lot of people. It draws around 3,000 people to New Bedford, a very popular event. As its name says, it's a half marathon. And for the first time in 43 years, they announced on Monday that they would cancel it because of the growing concerns about coronavirus. It was the first of a number of cancellations all week long on South Coast. And people were a little sad to see that happen, although they understood. At the starting gate and the finishing gate, which are the same spot near New Bedford City Hall, the people are packed in very closely, you know, to watch this run. And it really was not, even though it was outdoors, not an optimum environment for things. And then also, you know, with 3,000 runners coming in, you have a lot of them getting ready at the local YMCA. And so there were just all kinds of logistical problems. So they announced they would cancel it for the first time.
When this announcement came out, as you said, this was earlier in the week. And when it came out, it seemed it was one of the earlier announcements to cancel a big event. And at the time, it seemed like, oh, geez, I can't believe they're going to be canceling this. And then, you know, as the days go by, the Boston Marathon put off now, and then all sporting events across the country essentially done for a little while.
Yeah, at first there was some questions raised as to did they act too precipitously. The mayor and the YMCA and the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick, who operate the race, said no, there was no way they could see this happening with people in such close quarters. And I guess they've been proven right as the week went on. The International Seafood Buyers Luncheon was also canceled, which is a big seafood luncheon where buyers come from all over the world, a lot of them from China, to the New Bedford waterfront to sample the different kinds of seafood that New Bedford is famous for. And that was canceled. And then the mayor is having a press conference at 11, and we'll see where it goes from there. People are wondering if it will go to the school system as it has in so many other places.
That is Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks for joining us this morning.
Nice to do it.
Nantucket may be an island out to sea, but it is not immune to impacts from the new coronavirus. Josh Balling joins us from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Tell us what's happening on the island now around this.
Well, a lot of preparations are being made for potential cases of coronavirus reaching the island. As of last night, as of this morning, there have been no presumed or confirmed cases on the island. One staff member from the school system has been self-quarantined for just about 2 weeks now since returning from a trip to Italy over winter break. Schools are still open, though, and they will remain open even if a confirmed case or two is reported, Superintendent Michael Kozort said. He said that the schools have a responsibility not only to educate kids, but in some cases, feed and shelter students during the day when their parents are at work or otherwise not around. Obviously, plans could change, he said, if additional cases are confirmed on the island beyond one or two, if that happens, and town officials say it's likely or possible that could very well happen, and decisions will be made. Town officials have been preparing the entire week meeting regularly, meeting daily, and have already temporarily canceled the meetings of advisory boards and work groups that don't have regulatory authority or take voting action. Several events, including the school play, the hospital's health fair, a 5K road race, an annual science festival. Many events have been postponed or canceled altogether over the next couple weeks and the next couple months, and those decisions are being made pretty much on an hourly basis at this point. The nursing home on the island, the R Island Home Nursing Home that the town runs, is not admitting visitors, and visitors are also being discouraged from coming to the Salt Marsh Senior Center. Town meeting is scheduled for April 4th, and the select board and the town moderator are considering postponing that at least a month. That decision is probably going to be made a week or 10 days before town meeting, but there are no plans at the moment to change the date of the April 14th annual town election, even if town meeting is postponed. Looking a little further down the line, as of today anyway, the Nantucket Daffodil Festival, which usually brings about 10,000 to 15,000 people to the island at the end of April, and the Nantucket Wine and Food Festival in June are still on, with decisions expected in the coming weeks. Nantucket High School graduation is still on, Superintendent Cozart said. So a very fluid situation. Again, we have got a running list on our website of the closures, cancellations, and postponements, and that's growing. It seems almost hourly, but at this point, it's business as usual as much as it can be, but the streets are quieter. Restaurants and businesses have fewer patrons, it seems. But again, schools are still open, and the meetings of town regulatory boards are still going on, but a lot of stuff has been canceled and shut down.
Briefly, you've got other news in the paper, too. A story in this week's paper about a new apartment complex being proposed for the Mid-Island with the potential for some affordable housing maybe here.
It is, and that's the good news for town officials and proponents of the project. It's a 22-unit rental housing project proposed for the middle of the island near the police and fire stations. And the plans, early plans anyway, that the planning board took a look at on Monday night, call for 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments in 5 buildings on a 2-acre lot with a large area of open space in the front. The property is now just home to a 4-bedroom ranch house, garage, and shed, but it has the potential to be subdivided and the potential in this zone for 7 lots and up to 21 houses if tertiary and secondary dwellings are being built. So the planning board liked what it saw, said there was a good use of the space. They appreciate the open space, and they appreciate the fact that the developer has said he would be interested in dedicating at least a portion of those apartment units to affordable housing that would certainly take care of some of the housing needs on the island and count toward the town's subsidized housing inventory, which they need to bolster to avoid future 40B projects out here.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Beata Cook has been chronicling life in Provincetown and reminiscing about the past for some years in a column in the Provincetown Banner. Now in her mid-90s, she has announced that she's probably writing her last few columns. Alex Darris joins us now from the Banner to talk about her and the community reaction to the news. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Hi.
Tell us about Beata Cook and what makes her columns in the paper so special.
Well, Beata's been writing the columns for, I don't even know how long, years. And it's kind of connected with people because she writes about her current and past adventures in Provincetown, usually about her relationships with her friends and family and neighbors. And it's she's just developed this huge pool of dedicated readers that they all kind of wrote in comments this week to the paper, and they all say that the first thing they turn to in the paper each Thursday is her column to see what she has to say. So
her column is unique in that it really captures her life, day-to-day life, and even as she's wrestling with these medical issues, and also weaves in these reminiscences of a Provincetown that's, you know, long gone by, Provincetown from the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one reader said that Beata embodies the spirit of Provincetown, and I think that's kind of the general gist of what everyone's saying, is that Beata reminds them, whether they were here 40 years ago or they came here in recent years for one summer, she's able to connect with so many different people with her columns, just because the way she writes is so honest, and it's like you're reading something that you're just talking to a friend when you're reading her columns. So
I like the idea of asking listeners to chime in, or readers, I'm sorry, it's radio, the readers to chime in about Beta's column and what they found so special about why it really touched them over the years. Were you surprised at the responses that came in?
We were surprised, but also we kind of knew that Beta has all these fans because people always kind of, even on Facebook, write on stories that have nothing to do with her column, just how much they love reading her stories each week and why it keeps them coming back to the paper and stuff. So, and definitely she's still, I want to make sure to mention, like, she's still writing. She's at home being taken by friends and family, and she turned in her column for already for next week. So everyone should make sure to open the banner and check that out.
Very good to hear. Alex Darris from the Provincetown Banner. Alex, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
A popular Oak Bluffs restaurant may be without a home soon. It's part of a contentious proposal to replace the building it's in now. Brian Dow joins us from the Martha's Vineyard Times with the story. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Steve.
Brian, you've got a transcript of part of a tense exchange at a public meeting about this between the developer and committee members, and it really seems to cut to the heart of what's at issue here.
Sure. So the Red Cat Kitchen, it's a really popular restaurant on Kennebec Ave in Oak Bluffs, and its home is this really old, dilapidated building that's been there for many, many years. And it was recently purchased by Brian Pakish, who's a developer on the island. He's a landscaper, and he's also an Oak Bluffs selectman. And after he purchased it, he came up with plans. He met with an architect, and they designed this big new building that would keep the restaurant on the bottom floor, and would add four apartments up top for living space. But the thing is that these are going to be market rate apartments, which a lot of people on the Martha's Vineyard Commission, which is the island's regional planning agency, were not particularly happy with. They want to see a lot more affordable housing on the island, a lot more workforce housing, community housing. So they really liked everything about this project, but they didn't like the apartment part of it. And subcommittee meeting of the Martha's Vineyard Commission on Monday, Brian Pakish met with the Land Use Planning Committee and got into a back and forth exchange with one of the commissioners, Joan Malkin, about it because they want to see, again, this they want to see affordable housing. And under the MVC's new affordable housing policy, people have to make some kind of contribution to affordable housing developers making any kind of building. So if people don't want to build a physical affordable housing unit, then they can make a monetary mitigation, right? So but under this new guideline, the monetary mitigation fee price goes way up. And so essentially, Brian Pakish would have to pay, depending on how many units the Martha's Vineyard Commission designates this new building as, he could pay upwards of, $250,000 and as low as $50,000. But at this meeting, the subcommittee meeting, the committee voted that there was an increase of two housing units, which would require Brian to pay around $110,000-$130,000. And Brian Pakish essentially said, we should stop the conversation right now and I should just withdraw the application. And that didn't really go over well with the committee members who asked him, who just said, hey, let us finish. And Pakish kept saying, I just don't want to waste your time. And they were a little offended by that. And it's not a solid decision yet, but the it will go to the full commission, who will then decide. So the Red Cat Kitchen, the restaurant, if he has to make this affordable housing contribution, he said that the restaurant's not going to be able to survive in that location. So it kind of hangs in the balance right now.
Hmm. You also have a coronavirus coverage in the paper this week, as everybody does. You have quite a comprehensive list of cancellations. Give us a sense of some of the things that aren't happening now on the Vineyard.
Yeah. Well, first off, there are no confirmed cases on Martha's Vineyard, but the island is taking a lot of precautions right now. Hospital, for instance, has just closed its cafeteria. Usually a lot of people from the public can go in there. The hospital's really trying to close out any non-essential visits to the hospital, especially to its nursing home facility, Windermere. There's also the Martha's Vineyard Film Festival has been canceled. A forum up in Chilmark to talk about designs, a public forum for designs for their new emergency facilities building was canceled. And that list, continues to grow. Actually, right before I got on the radio, the Up Island Council on Aging just told me that, they wanted to be put on the our list of events that had been canceled because all of their activities had been canceled. So that list keeps growing. And while there are no confirmed cases on the island, the hospital CEO, Denise Peachy, has told us that she does anticipate a case coming on the island. So right now the island's just gearing up and kind of taking a lot of precautions and playing things on the safe side.
Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Coronavirus was the top story this week on Beacon Hill as well. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about how lawmakers have reacted as the numbers of cases has steadily risen in the state.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Lots of things have happened this week. Let's start first with the governor declaring a state of emergency.
Yeah, Governor Baker declared a state of emergency, which for the time being really allows him to cut through a lot of red tape. At the press conference where he announced the decision, he said that he doesn't want to have to, ask for further authority when it comes to things like, canceling large events or, stockpiling medical gear in certain places, things like that, that the emergency declaration allows the governor to do without going to the legislature to seek extra authority. He did talk about potentially having to order the cancellation or postponement of certain large public gatherings. Right now, though, it seems like on a voluntary basis, most organizers of large gatherings are definitely taking those precautions very seriously. The other major thing that happened this week is that the legislature has moved a $15 million fund in place for public health at the state and local level. This essentially backs up the blank check that Baker gave to DPH to deal with preparations and especially with testing. There's a lot of overtime hours that need to be paid for as testing for the disease ramps up.
Mm-hmm. And we should be clear that, he has restricted some employees in his administration with traveling and things like that and suggested that of businesses. Not mandatory yet for businesses, but many big companies are following suit.
Yeah, I think almost all employers are taking a look at how to get their employees to telecommute, what they can and can't do remotely. Almost everyone's kind of experimenting with different kinds of telecommuting and, web access and things like that. So that's going to be a kind of a major test for all of us. But there are plenty of quasi-public agencies, legislative employees, constitutional officers. All those offices are still open. However, it's at the discretion of those authorities to, encourage telecommuting, things like that.
What about for members of the press like you? I mean, you're up there every single day working from the State House. Would they restrict the press?
I'd say it's doubtful that they would restrict press access at a time like this, mostly because that public information messaging, that is so important to the story, and that's what these public health officials and the governor really want to get out there over and over again. So to limit press would be an odd choice. It would have to be very, very, very serious, I think, if that were to happen. Baker has been holding pretty regular press conferences since he came back from his trip. DPH Administrator Burrell has also also been very accessible in Health and Human Services Secretary Sutter's. And so the State House is kind of ground zero for the public information campaign.
Okay, I want to switch to something non-coronavirus related that was kind of a big story before coronavirus kind of took over, is transportation issues. The House put out a plan last week. Speaker Robert DeLeo approved some tax hikes. The state Senate, though, maybe not so willing to go along with some of these tax hikes and get them to Governor Baker's desk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was the big story before coronavirus kind of hit. It looks like the House and Senate may not be on the same page when it comes to these gas tax and corporate tax hikes to pay for roads, bridges, and especially the MBTA going forward. The Senate says they're going to present their own plan right before their budget, meaning that things might come down to the wire between the House and Senate. If this gets to become a long, drawn-out debate between the chambers, like we've seen countless times before, it could delay that budget getting finalized, complicate the end of session when a number of other major pieces of legislation need to be considered. So this really could become the elephant in the room if the House and Senate don't get their act together and compromise in a speedy way.
And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. The state scheduled 7 public meetings this month to talk about how it plans to address climate change and reduce its greenhouse gas emissions and ask for feedback on those plans. Not sure with the coronavirus if all of those will get done, but WCAI's Eve Zuckoff went to one of the earlier meetings. It was at Bristol College in Fall River, and she joins me now. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
Before we get into the reactions in the room to all of this, tell us about the state's plans and what kind of feedback the state is looking for here.
Yeah, so, okay, so bear in mind, it's a bit of a mouthful because it's the state. The state has been working for a while on a 2050 climate plan, and the goal there is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere from the year 1990 by 80%. So it's the 80 by 50 plan. Then the governor said, you know, we actually want to get to net zero by 2050. We want to reduce the amount of emissions in the atmosphere to be equal to the amount we're pulling out. So now the question is, how much of a reduction do you want to see in the year 2030? These kind of benchmarks years getting you to 2050.
So 10 years from now.
10 years from now, exactly. Do you want to see a 70% reduction, 75%? Those stricter limits for that 2030 year will translate to more aggressive and immediate changes, theoretically at least, in transportation, building, and energy sectors. So there are real consequences for where you set that limit in 2030.
So you were in Fall River where they talked about this. What kind of reactions did you hear from people in the room?
Yeah, it was angry. It was an angry crowd from the 36 or so folks who turned up. I mean, and their main position was, you know, asking a question about where should this 2030 goal be if it's a 70% reduction. 70% isn't enough. 95% might be enough given the concerns that so many of them have about climate change.
So these were environmental people pushing the state to move even faster and harder on this.
Absolutely. There were also some folks there who said, you know, I'm concerned about the cost. If you really want to change transportation to be greener, what does that cost to me and my community? How does that benefit my community even? But for the most part, the anger was coming from people who were saying, look, I get and appreciate that you're doing a lot of planning, but we need immediate and aggressive action now. One woman said, these efforts are kindergarten compared to what we really have facing us.
How did the state respond to this kind of feedback?
Yeah, the state, they were mostly saying, you know, we're just trying not to reinvent the wheel here. We're doing what so many other states are doing. And to give the state some credit, we as a state are actually farther ahead than many other states in this kind of planning. They wanted to emphasize that. But mainly they were saying, we're listening. We want to take down these notes. We want to just get your feedback. And they're still looking for feedback. People can submit it online through April 10th. As we know, the next meeting is in Springfield, but we don't quite know, you know, when the next meeting will be. But yeah, they're looking to ultimately set that 2030 emissions goal by the end of this year. So we'll see.
That is WCAI's climate and environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to all my guests this morning. We had Ethan Genter in studio from the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We talked to Jack Spillane at the Standard Times, Alex Darris at the Provincetown Banner, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Mike Dean up at the State House. We took you all around the region. Bring you right back home again. It's Going on 10 o'clock. I'm Steve Junker. Thanks for listening.